720 WGN. Amy Guth with you till at 2 when we turn things over to Dave Plyer. My friends, we talk about a lot of things on this show, and they're usually funny, but not always. And sometimes they are heavy and they are complex, and sometimes they're lighter and simpler, and sometimes they're a mix of the two. But I think that we can all agree, every one of us, that the state of racial issues and racial justice and everything that goes with it in our country right now is quite serious and quite polarizing. And there's a lot to it, and it's complex, and there's a lot going on. We are indeed in this country having a moment. I think we can all agree on that for sure. So we're very honored right now to have joining us on the program multimedia journalist and my op-ed project colleague, Mary Curtis, who writes and comments extensively about race and politics for a lot of publications. Google her, my friends. She is everywhere. And she's all over television nationally and locally. And she has many, many wonderful perspectives on lots of things. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And it's Mary C. Curtis if you Google me.
That's true. Don't forget that C.
Can't forget my grandma, Mary Cecilia. But it's so good to be with you, Amy. And you talk about the mix of emotions, and you have all that mix of emotions here. You had this week a certain amount of elation when the flag came down, the Confederate flag, from the South Carolina State House grounds. But then there's so much serious pieces to this conversation, because you realize the only reason we're talking is because nine incredible people were slaughtered, nine African Americans in their church murdered in an act of domestic terrorism by a white supremacist, a young man, and in a historic church. And so there are all kinds of emotions, because we realize this is an incredible cost to have paid.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it so ironic? I mean, chillingly so, that of all people to have launched this conversation that ultimately led to the Confederate flag being taken down was this young man and his actions. You know, this, I mean, there's no way he could have foreseen this being the outcome. It clearly wasn't the outcome he wanted, but here we are.
Yes, here we are. And and while people like to say, well, this was this lone wolf, this person who was insane, he had the support and got inspiration from these white supremacist groups that are all over the internet with like-minded folks that have really just blossomed since the election of the president, first African-American president, Barack Obama. And anytime you have progress, there is pushback. And there will be a Klan rally on the State House grounds just in the next coming week. So you see that it's just not one person. And it's interesting, because this young man, the people do try to distance themselves. You don't hear him referred to as a thug. You don't hear people talk about a dysfunctional white culture as you do if it were reversed. So we do have a long ways to go. But, yeah, I was at the funeral of the Reverend Clemente Pinckney when the president spoke. And you realize just that it is not just this big headline, but these are human beings. His widow was there, his two little children. We talk about African-American fathers. He was a wonderful father, and he is taken away from his children, who wrote these incredibly heartrending poems to him in the program at the church. And so it is so many mixed emotions, because these are human beings. And if you look at their resumes, all of them were just giving so much to our society that no matter what color, gender, whatever you are, you would want these people to be in your world.
Indeed. You know, talk us through that funeral in particular, because there were so many moments that were captured in sound bites for people who were not there, including the president singing Amazing Grace and suddenly kind of taking that room by surprise, and these very beautiful words by Clementa Pinckney's children and widow that were, you know, little bits and pieces have kind of been shared. But you were there. Kind of talk us through, because it was quite long, and you wrote quite a bit about it.
Yes, I did write about it. I was there from, 3:30 or so in the morning with a local television, a Charlotte television show I do. that I contribute to, and people were already in line, many dressed in white, because even though it didn't start until 11, if you weren't in line about 6 or 7 in the morning, you would not get in. And they had moved it from the church to an arena on the in the College of Charleston, so many people could come in. And so many, it's interesting, journalists stand apart from things, and particularly many who haven't attended a black church funeral. And even though I'm African-American, as I wrote, I'm Catholic, this isn't my funeral tradition either. It's not my church tradition. But you could not help but be moved. And I talked to people there, and they had mixed feelings at first, because many who knew him, and I spoke with even some of his childhood friends, they felt, well, is this going to overshadow the man? The president's here. All these thousands of people are here. The media cameras are here. But they felt that it did catch his essence, because instead of the service being transformed by all these things happening around it, actually the people there were transformed because it was so heartfelt, and many people got up and spoke. And even the president, you could see him being moved by it. And, you know, the call and response where the organ would come in and punctuate some of the things he said, people aren't used to that, you know. And it was a moment to be there. I had driven from Charlotte that day. I was pretty much up for 24 hours. And I was really glad I did, because to be there and to share that, it was a transformational, even I would say spiritual experience, even if you're not someone who is a particularly spiritual person. Mm-hmm. So that was amazing. But it was a sense of loss as well, because, you know, I here in Charlotte, someone who lives here who's was from Charleston, but a former city councilman and state senator in North Carolina, Malcolm Graham, his sister was the librarian, Cynthia Graham Hurd, who was killed. And he and his wife and kids have started a foundation with Freedom School to work on literacy issues, which, of course, was basically her pet project. So to be there was just to feel the human side of it that may get lost when you're thinking of this headline, all of these people killed. So I'm really glad I went. But talking to folks like the Congressman Clyburn,
okay, now,
and others there, it was interesting too, because they're saying,
no.
Let's just be
David, your microphone is on. Sorry,
no.
Mary. David.
11. Hello? Okay.
David Jennings, your microphone is on, and you are we are trying to talk.
And the Iran nuke talks. We move
David.
That in.
Mary, I'm sorry.
Who is this?
This is David Jennings on the news, and
he
does not realize his microphone is on right now. There we go.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
No,
here we
David.
Go.
David Jennings, your microphone is on.
Hello?
There we go. Sorry, Mary.
That's live radio.
That's right.
Coming at you. No, but
with
I was
it.
Just saying that many folks who work with him, particularly in the legislature, wanted to... do you want to get that straightened out?
We sure do. You know what? We're going to go to break real quick. When we come back, we're talking with Mary Curtis. She's a multimedia journalist, and she covers race and politics, and we're talking about some of her recent stories. We'll be right back in just a bit. 720 WGN. All right, 720 WGN, we had some technical difficulties, so sorry if you heard a little bit of overlap, a little bit of stuff there, a little bit of chaos. The joys of live radio, my friend, the joys of live radio. Anyway, so right before the break, we were talking with Mary Curtis, Mary C. Curtis. If you Google her, that C is very important. She is a multimedia journalist and also my colleague at the Op-Ed Project. And she covers issues of race and politics and sometimes the arts even. You had a wonderful piece just recently about Misty Copeland that was excellent, that I really, really loved. But we were talking right before the break, we were talking about how you attended Clementa Pinckney's funeral. And just the emotion in the room and the writing that you did about it, and how you described all these things that we've really, those of us who were not there, have really only kind of seen and heard in sound bites, like the president singing and the remarks made by Reverend Pinckney's children and widow and all of those kind of things. But really the room was so much more, really. We were talking about that a bit. And also for such a tender and kind of beautiful part of, you know, a tragic thing, you know, this very beautiful celebration of this man's life. Then we have, you know, later this week, we have the KKK saying they're going to have a rally on the statehouse grounds in South Carolina. I don't know if you plan to write about that. Certainly seems like a topic you would tackle given your expertise, but...
Well, I'm not sure if I'm going to go down there. I did a narrative story on Confederate heritage groups a few years ago where I visited meetings of the League of the South, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and many, many different groups, some of whom were more interested in putting wreaths on graves, and others who felt that they would like to secede now from the Union. They feel that this country has gone downhill because the South lost the Civil War. And you see that the war is still being fought, because even though the flag did come down, there was hours, there were hours and hours of debates where folks got up and spoke, and some did not want it to come down. The piece of it is, you can still have it in your private life, in your home, a tattoo if you like. But the sticking point was that this is on public grounds of the State House that says it represents all South Carolinians. And in the discussion, when people talk about its heritage, I think sometimes it gets lost that there are many black Southerners and black South Carolinians, and also folks of every color who don't want this particular flag to represent them. And the fact that it hasn't been flying there since the Civil War, since the 1860s, but only the 1960s, when it was kept up to as a protest against civil rights gains. So it always has had that feeling about it. So many folks that they talk with when it came down, people said, you know, now I won't have to avert my eyes because it really hurt. Mm-hmm. And at the funeral, when I spoke with, as I said, folks like Mark Morial and Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina, who knew the Reverend Pinckney and was still feeling incredibly stunned, said, you know, this is a wonderful symbol, but then what are the next steps? As a state senator, Senator Pinckney worked for health care for children, because South Carolina is one of those states that didn't take the Medicaid expansion. So what are his colleagues going to do about that? What are some of the discussions going to turn to when it comes to economic, social, political structures and inequality, when it comes to schools and the fact that so many black and brown young people are suspended in disproportionate numbers, even when the offenses are the same, and this happens all over the country? What happens with housing? We just this week saw, just in the last week or so, that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is trying to put some teeth in the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which it's been illegal, but still in practice, we see these housing sort of pockets of discrimination and segregation. You know, in Chicago, your own city, it's one of the most segregated in the country when it comes to housing patterns. So we don't know each other. You can choose to live in your life, whether you go to church at a certain place or live in a certain neighborhood or go to a certain school, and basically live a segregated life. So how are we going to get to know our fellow citizens? So what is going to happen after this horrific event? We've seen events in the past when the four little girls, again in a church, black churches have often been the scenes of attack, were bombed in Birmingham. You saw civil rights legislation. So you see these steps of progress, but it seems to always come at these horrific costs to shock the country into seeing, you know what, not only are we not post-racial, but we have to deal with things we have not dealt with. And in this case, it was the Civil War, which, you know, 150
You'd think we'd
years
be over that by now, right?
Yeah, well, you still have people arguing about the causes of the Civil War, which was astonishing because you've been taught a certain thing. It's about states' rights or whatever, where all you have to do is read the original documents of secession and the Confederate Constitution to see that slavery really was the cause. So it is, in a way, very frustrating. But as you said, at least we are talking, and people need to see that. But look at, you know, now you have Donald Trump talking about immigration in a way that is And I used to live in Arizona, too. I think I lived everywhere with many Hispanics. And he just drew a huge crowd in Phoenix, saying some very incendiary things, taking a few cases and saying this represents everyone,
right.
And all the immigrants who come into this country from Mexico. So I think it's very obvious that we need to have conversations and maybe start off with people we trust, because when you start it at such a high decibel level, nobody will be listening.
Truly, truly. All right, my friends, we're talking with Mary C. Curtis, multimedia journalist, and my colleague at the Op-Ed Project. She covers race and politics for all kinds of places, NPR, Women's Media Center, The Root, WCCB News, NPR. Oh, my gosh, she is everywhere. We're going to keep her a little bit longer. Can you stay up with us, Mary?
I would love to, because you know I love working with you, Amy. I think we make quite a pair.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We're a good team, Mary. And there's so much more I want to talk with you about, because there's really just so much to the to everything that's going on right now. But my friends, we got to take a quick break first. We'll be right back. 720 WGN.
Zing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
720 WGN. Amy Guth with you till about 2 o'clock when we turn things over to Dave Plyer. My friends, before the break, we were talking with journalist Mary C. Curtis and my colleague at the Op-Ed Project, because she was at the Clementa Pinckney funeral, and although we have all heard just little clips of it, like what we just heard of President Obama singing Amazing Grace quite suddenly and off the cuff, moved by the room and the moment, the real weight of the day, of the event, and of the events that led to it, were certainly not lost on anybody in that room. Mary, thanks for sticking with us through the break. I want to talk to you, too, about a piece you wrote recently in womensmediacenter.com about how young people can't solve America's race challenges on their own.
Well, yes, you often hear people say, well, the young people are our hope because they have friends of different races and they are going to solve the problem. But we see Dylann Roof was 21, I believe, years old. He was a young person, and he was a little lost in his life. It seems he dropped out of high school a couple of times, and he had his criminal record of some sort. And instead of working on his own self, he basically blamed it on black people. Basically, if you aren't succeeding, somehow it's their fault, and they, as he said, you're taking over the country. So we see that a lot of our young people need to know our history too. There have been studies that show that the whole issue of saying be colorblind and don't see color doesn't really work, because our young people have just as many racial stereotypes, and so that we need to be honest with them and open with them and have these discussions and make sure every generation is working on it. So at the same time, during the break, I was thinking, we're sounding kind of negative in some ways, and it's true we have problems, but there is hope. There's been progress. That president that was singing Amazing Grace was elected in the United States, and yes, there's been a lot of pushback. And some of it, I think, has to do with race, like he wasn't born in this country. But he was elected twice. And I was recently over in Germany speaking about race issues. And I was pushing back a little bit, because when I go elsewhere, I do defend my country. Mm-hmm. And I said, can you see yourselves having elected Afro-German, an Asian German, a Turkish German person to the highest office in your land? No, not really. So there has been a lot of progress made. The neighborhood I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, many of the homes had deeds and the restrictive covenants in the deeds saying you cannot sell to someone who is not of the Caucasian race. And they're not enforceable now, but until the 60s, 70s, 80s, you would see these things being, people being steered out of certain neighborhoods. So things have changed in many ways, but it is always a fight. And you will see some news stories later in the month coming out of Charlotte about a white police officer who will be on trial for killing a young, unarmed African-American man, Jonathan Farrell, who was going for help after a car accident. You might have heard a little bit about it. You'll be hearing more. And we have these issues of policing. And, yes, my own son has been stopped in this great neighborhood questioning why he's here. So this is what I mean about we can be optimistic and hopeful. Mm-hmm. But the young people have to realize that nothing, no progress is made throughout our history, whether it's women getting the vote or any of these things, without folks in power saying, well, okay, there's going to be some pushback. And that's the life we have to live with, that we can have a wonderful life and be positive, but also know we have to be mindful of these things. So that funeral and what's gone on is a reminder of all of that, that yes, there is progress at incredible cost, but here we are, and these people did show grace and forgiveness. And I think that was great that they did that for themselves, because they have to live on and they don't want to be negative. But at the same time, there is some anger there, and that has to be acknowledged too. We see that when the folks in the Boston bombing, the terrorist bombing, many of the families were very angry in the courtroom, and we allowed that. We gave them that righteous anger. Sometimes I feel in this country there is a little bit of fear of when minorities have anger at some things that have happened, when it's righteous anger. We're all human beings. We all have a variety of emotions. We should be able to express all of them. You know, I feel joy. I feel love, sometimes despair, and sometimes anger. We are many things.
Truly, truly. You know, you mentioned, historic pushback, the women's movement, other movements in history. How do you think history is going to categorize this last year?
Well, I would like to think it's some sort of turning point. We are talking about issues of fair policing, issues of social mobility, issues of fairness in wages, these kinds of things. You have seen activists, even young folks like Charlotte's own Bree Newsom that climbed up that pole in Charleston and took that down, which harkens back to civil disobedience from the civil rights era. I had a brother who was arrested twice during sit-ins. And I think that this killing was so shocking, I would like to think that it causes folks to have a certain amount of introspection. Maybe history will say America grew up a little bit. America started to become a little more honest with itself and with its past and its present, and how we are all creatures of our whole histories. I would like to think that, because at heart I am an optimistic person, and because I have a child, and I want his world to be better. He's an activist himself, so
how could he not be? You are his mother. How could he not
be? Well, I don't know. You know how sometimes people do the exact opposite. Maybe he'll go to Wall Street or something, but he is not that, particularly in areas of housing and labor and fairness. He is that kind of person, which I am thrilled. And I just want him to get a really good job after he's graduating from graduate school, but that's another. I think all parents want that.
Truly. You mentioned a time, I think the phrase you used was being more honest with ourselves as a nation. And, you know, I can't help but wonder the role that bystander video and social media plays in that to some degree, because I think there's one thing to hear about a crime, or there's one thing to hear about an issue of like police reaction that we, you know, people may or may not agree with. But I think it's quite another to see it, to see it on video now at a time where all of us can pull out our phones and shoot video and share it with the entire world. I think that may be part of why we're suddenly kind of being confronted with things in a much different way, because we see them in undeniable frames.
You're right. You're totally right, Amy. And there's a little bit of frustration because people have been saying, people have been talking about this, citizens of the United States, for hundreds of years, that this is, these behaviors have happened. Yes, I was pulled over and I wasn't doing anything. And I did a piece for the Washington Post, when white friends don't believe what their black friends have gone through, they're not your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you say something and they say, what, you must have been doing something, or they wouldn't pull you over for nothing. And now these videos show, wow, this guy was shot in the back, you
mm-hmm.
know, murdered in North Charleston, actually, Walter Scott. And I think that has a big piece to do with it, because it is, people want to see something. So God bless them, you know, that we have now cell phones. And also, I believe that it's becoming very obvious that the country is becoming much more diverse. So we have to do it for our survival. If we want to make sure that we take advantage of the intellectual capital, of the potential, of the gifts of every single one of our citizens, which we have to do to succeed as a country, then we have to make sure that everybody has a fair shot.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is self-interest. We want to be a successful country. We want to make sure that the cure for cancer or the next big invention in the internet or whatever is not lost because the person who would come up with it is not being nurtured.
Truly, truly. All right, my friends, we're talking with Mary C. Curtis, award-winning multimedia journalist. She's based in Charlotte. She's also my colleague and friend at the Op-Ed Project. We have to take a very quick break, and we come back more with Mary C. Curtis, 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth hanging out with you till 2 o'clock. My friends, we've been talking with award-winning multimedia journalist Mary C. Curtis. She's also my friend and colleague at the Op-Ed Project. She writes about race and politics for all kinds of places, for NPR, Women's Media Center, Washington Post, New York Times, you name it. She is all over the place. You can find her everywhere you look, and she writes about very important topics, especially lately. There's so much in the news that really weighing on everybody's hearts and minds that she has tackled. A little bit earlier in the show, we had kind of a technical difficulty. Culprit of said technical difficulty, I've made him stay past his shift, and he's hanging out with us in the studio right now.
Mm-hmm.
David.
That's
smack.
Okay. If you want to join in, that's fine. By the way, if you want to follow me, Twitter, anything. If you look up MaryCCurtis.com as my website, you can figure all of it out. And we were talking about African-American achievement, but American achievement, how about Serena Williams?
I know, right?
And Mary, the sad thing is there are still people who have not just accepted her for being a great tennis player in
That's
certain respects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if in certain circles in our little world, if you're an African-American, even if you are working harder than everyone else, if you do everything that our parents' generation told us we had to do, you still can't win.
Oh, yeah. Hers is an American story. Two little girls playing tennis on a broken, cracked tennis court in Compton, California, and becoming champions. And she, I tell you, sometimes when I see that she is playing in the United States and she's playing someone from another country and she's actually booed by people in the United States, it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also see body image. There was a story, I think, in the New York Times where she's a powerful person. And that's what an athlete looks like. Look at our soccer players. Look how they were celebrated. And yet she gets criticism. And it's amazing because she's one of the finest athletes of the 20th century, let's face it. And she is just, I admire her because despite all of that, she just goes out and wins. And I think you're exactly right, because as I said, what as you said very eloquently, when you do all the things you are supposed to do, look at the resumes of every single person killed at Emmanuel AME, the things that they were doing to help all of us. And even they were so nice to the person who came in to visit the church who ended up. Mm-hmm. He had all these stereotypes about black people, and the black people he met were not, they were nice to him than anyone in his life.
Right.
And he still had this mission that he went through with. Whereas if he would just believe the evidence there, he would have said, my goodness, what I've been hearing, this is ridiculous.
Right, I've got it all wrong.
I've got it all wrong because they were so kind. And that's the power of some of these ridiculous, horrible, corrosive stereotypes.
Mary, I have to wonder if part of the problem here isn't that as a society, we are no longer nearly as well informed with facts as we used to be, going back to the days of Walter Cronkite.
Well, that's part of it. It used to be there were fewer outlets, and everybody had the communal things they looked at, whether it was, I don't know, the Johnny Carson show or Walter Cronkite. Now there are so many different little cable outlets and also websites that you can have a worldview, and you could go to wherever reinforces that particular worldview. So people will say, oh, I read this on the internet, and it will be the most outlandish myth or false thing, and you'll say, but it's not true. There are certain things that you have the right to your own opinion, but not the right to your own facts.
Like right. the people in Texas who are complaining that the federal government's military exercise is the precursor or pretense for an invasion of the state?
Oh, yes. And
I was stunned to see the reactions of some of the people there.
And then also some of the politicians that those are their voters, so they're dancing around it and saying, well, you know, the governor, we're keeping an eye on that, instead of saying to people, this is totally ridiculous.
Right.
Read a book.
It's right. It's so interesting how right now we have more access to information than ever and easier than ever. And yet people I worry very much about media literacy, because here we are, we have so much information. As you said, it's very easy to just align yourself with the worldview that you want. And you know, I often fret that elections are won and lost on email forwards written in Comic Sans, right? Because people send these strange things.
I grew up in West Baltimore. I had the same zip code as Freddie Gray. And even that, watching the media cover it, was so frustrating to me, because they didn't cover the funeral, the peaceful protests, anything like that. Right across the street from where the same corner where the CVS was burning is a library where I got my library card when I was 3 years old, at the corner of Penn and North, which is, as you say, you know, my parents took me there, five kids they taught us, and we had to know the facts, right? Read. Educate yourself. And that stayed open throughout. It wasn't touched. It was a refuge for adults and children. Nobody knows that, because what sells?
Mm-hmm.
What sells?
If it bleeds,
and
it leaves.
Broke my heart. Because I know that area, and I know all the issues that were there, of the jobs moving out, of abandoned houses, of really good people that are trying to live there, and most people in any neighborhood are law-abiding people. And people said, well, the violence started, a window was broken. I said, well, no, didn't the violence start with someone's spine was broken? We can frame it any way we want. And as a person who's in the media, when I am a part of a story and I can see it myself and I see somehow how people get it so wrong, it is just a frustration. It's very frustrating to me.
Well, you know, as much as you cover these, you know, very weighty and complex topics, you know, once in a while your area of expertise of race and politics kind of ventures into another area, and once in a while that's the arts, and that.
Oh, I love the arts.
You know, and
we
were talking about Serena and how people, you know, often talk about their bodies in a different way than they ought, and body image, and how much that comes up when we talk about Venus and Serena Williams. But, you know, that came up a bit recently with Misty Copeland in ballet, and how that kind of, and her You know, you wrote about her too a bit, about how she challenged a lot of stereotypes as well.
Yes, I wrote about that because, as you know, I love the arts, and a frustration for me with some of the public schools when they say you just have to stick with reading and writing and we can cut out sports and the arts. And I know that the arts are something lovely. Even if you don't make a living at it, you can enjoy them and they enrich your life. And somehow, sometimes children get into their studies through the arts. So, and with Misty and the ballet world, I've loved ballet, but you did not see a lot of particularly African-American women on the ballet stage. It's not that they weren't trained in there, because you can go back to folks like Raven Wilkinson and Janet Collins and others who were there for many years and very qualified. But the stereotypes about black women, as I wrote in that, worked against them in the ballet world, because we think of withering little ballerinas, very delicate princesses who, you know, throw themselves into lakes for the man they love. And the stereotype of black women is strong and aggressive, and so even when they got into ballet with Misty Copeland, you can do Firebird, the fiery roles, those kinds of things. But can you do Swan Lake? Can you do those, the princess roles? Because we aren't seen as that. And that worked into it, into that story. So her breaking this barrier is beyond the ballet world, because it also increases and broadens what people think of as the image of African-American women. We can be, as I said before, all of those things. And I spoke to a ballerina here, former ballerina, who's now the head of the director of the school at the Charlotte Ballet. And I remember seeing her on stage, and she's stunning. And she actually grew up in the Chicago area, Oak Park, and she was in that parade that you have.
Bud Billiken.
Yes, and her name is Aisha McMillan, and now Mary Cravata. And from the age of 2 to 29, she danced, and she ran into that stereotype. But now you're seeing more young people of color get into the ballet schools, and you see more directors being diverse. And then part of it is, of course, you want diverse audiences. So as I say, some of that is the bottom line. You want to see all kinds of people in the audiences. And the crowds went wild for Misty Copeland. When she dances, you can't get near it, and the people are crowded at the stage door. And if you ask anybody of any race who doesn't even know anything about ballet, name a ballet dancer, they'd say Misty Copeland.
She is
because she's gone beyond that. And it almost seems that for an African-American, you have to be almost super in a way. As you were talking about Serena before, you have to go beyond to get that recognition. But by her being named a principal dancer, that will, I believe, open doors. So you will see that. But it is kind of interesting. And I asked, how come it seems African-American men, you don't see a lot of them in the ballet, but they are a little bit more successful. And Aisha said, well, you know, the stereotype of black men of being strong and virile works for them when it comes to being a partner in the ballet world, because that's what you think a partner is. So it's kind of interesting how these stereotypes can play around with them. And I just hate them all together, because, you know, that's sort of like when people talk about black culture. And what is that? You know, what is that? Is that what? You know, I love all kinds of things. And people need to be thought of as individuals. And I think that that's what we need to get past, because I do think that whites do have that privilege that if a white person does something horrible, like a Dylann Roof or whatever, it doesn't extend to, oh, why, my God, what's wrong with white people? But you see that when it happens, say, to a Muslim American or a Hispanic American or an African American, somebody can do something and all of a sudden it becomes an indictment of everyone.
Right.
And I think people just need to look at people as individuals.
Indeed, indeed. And as you pointed out, nobody called Dylann Roof a thug. They said he was a troubled young man.
Yeah, they didn't ask him how low he wore his pants.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
That sounds silly when you think of it, but if you
But it matters, it
around,
but it's true.
It matters. I mean, and as I said, I have some, as they say, skin in the game, because I have a son, and my husband happens to be Caucasian, and So he has a black wife and a black son, so he's very much aware of these issues in many ways. But even if you don't have that, I think our neighbors and friends and coworkers have to have that empathy, even if it's not someone in your own family. I think with the, you see, with the same-sex marriage and LGBT movement, a lot of that was because so many people had friends and folks in their families, and then they looked at the dinner table, and it was their son or daughter, and you can't be prejudiced. You cannot make them the other when it's someone you love.
Truly, truly. Fine words from multimedia award-winning journalist Mary C. Curtis. Mary, thank you so much for being with us tonight. You are always a joy, and you can just call us up anytime you want. I'm always happy to have you on the show.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I want to talk more with a friend who interrupted me.
He's over here. I put him in timeout for a minute, but
okay, he's great. Tell him that's okay. He's just trying to keep us on our game
and
show your listeners what live radio is about.
I'm sorry.
You owe me. When I come to Chicago, you owe me.
Okay.
You owe me dinner.
You got a deal.
All right. There it is. All right. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Thanks. Have a great night. Follow her at she's mcurtisnc3 on Twitter and find marycurtis.com. All those good places. Go there. Find her. Read her. Google her. Don't forget that C, that middle initial. It's very, very important. Mary C. Curtis.
I'm Catholic. That sounds like the rosary piece. Mary Cecilia.
That's right. All right. Thanks very much, Mary.
You take care. See you soon.
All right. All right, my friends, we got to take a quick break, go to news and all that fun stuff. We'll be right back. 720 WGN.